Hello there. Today is Tuesday, July 16th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Lori London in Washington. Coming up, Democrats in Congress attacked by President Trump deemed his comments a racist.
It is time for us to stop allowing this president to make a mockery out of our Constitution.
European leaders look for ways to salvage the Iran nuclear deal that President Trump pulled out of. Also ahead, an anniversary of astronomical proportions. It's all on today's International Edition. Donald Trump doubled down on his attacks against four minority U.S. congresswomen Monday and dismissed concerns that his comments were racist, prompting outrage from Democrats who moved to condemn him in the House of Representatives. Speaking at the White House, Trump was asked if he was concerned that his comments are being called racist.
It doesn't concern me because many people agree with me. And all I'm saying, they want to leave, they can leave.
Those remarks followed his Twitter messages Sunday that said the four minority Democratic lawmakers known in Congress as the Squad should go back to the totally broken and crime-infested places from which they came. All four of the first-term House members are U.S. citizens, and all but one were born in the United States. Representatives Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, Ilhan Omar, Ayanna Pressley, and Rashida Tlaib of Michigan held a news conference on Monday to fight back against the president's comments. Here's a sampling.
We cannot allow these hateful actions by the president to distract us from the critical work to hold this administration accountable to the inhumane conditions at the border that is separating children from their loved ones and caging them up in illegal, horrific conditions.
We ran on a mandate to advocate for and to represent those ignored, left out, and left behind. Our squad is big. Our squad includes any person committed to building a more equitable and just world. And that is the work that we want to get back to. And given the size of this squad and this great nation, we cannot, we will not be silenced.
What I want to tell children across this country is that no matter what the president says, this country belongs to you. Mm-hmm. And it belongs to everyone. And today, that notion, that very notion, was challenged.
We can either continue to enable this president and report on the bile of garbage that comes out of his mouth, or we can hold him accountable to his crimes.
Well, joining us now to talk more are Trump's remarks were widely derided as racist, and even some of his fellow Republicans did speak out. The latest remarks came on the same day that the Trump administration unveiled a new rule to bar almost all immigrants from applying for asylum at the southern border, requiring them to first pursue safe haven in a third country through which they had traveled on the way to the United States. Now joining us to talk more about all of this is Cecilia Wang, Deputy Legal Director with the American Civil Liberties Union. Thank you for being with us. So first off, your reaction to the president's controversial comments about these congresswomen.
What really stood out to me as a person of color, as an Asian American, is that this refrain of go back where you came from is something that I think every person of color in the United States can really identify with. Whether we're immigrants or born in the United States, it's a common racist refrain that we've grown up hearing, that we keep hearing as adults, whenever someone wants to exclude us from our own country. And to hear this coming from the President of the United States, though not surprising given who occupies the White House right now, was still a really devastating blow. I thought about myself as a child hearing that phrase. I thought about all of the American kids now who are hearing this vile phrase come out of the mouth of the president and aimed at members of Congress, no less. So it was really a sickening feeling. Literally, I felt it in the pit of my stomach.
We even heard from leaders of foreign countries, including Canada and Britain, which is very unusual for them to really ever get involved in anything that happens here like that.
Yeah, and I think for any country that considers itself to be based on values, shared values, rather than an ethnic identity, like the countries you mentioned, in addition to our country, I think it really strikes a blow at that notion that we, out of many, we are one. And it was a message of exclusion. It also, of course, coincided with the day that President Trump had announced would be a day of immigration raid on diverse cities, particularly diverse cities and immigrant communities around the United States. And so, of course, that was another message of exclusion that was sent out. So for children and in families that have people of mixed status, including U.S. citizens, to lawfully present immigrants, to people who are here without documentation, the message on Sunday coming from the president was one of double terror. First, he announced that he would be sending immigration agents into our communities around the country. And then he was saying, you don't belong here, including to U.S. citizens and members of Congress who happen to be people of color. So he was definitely speaking to a certain base of his own constituency. We heard, of course, on social media, people who monitor white supremacist websites and chat rooms and the like were saying that they were all in a tizzy and an uproar supporting the president as he lashed out at these women of color who are serving in the United States Congress. And I think that had to be part of his, his plan in the United States Congress. And I think that had to be part of his, his plan.
Right. You know, we've been hearing a lot about how this is a premeditated strategy for the president to appeal to a certain group of people in the United States ahead of the next presidential election.
I think it was certainly intentional that he wanted to stir up controversy and speak to what I believe is a minority, a small but very vocal and insidious minority in this country that finds his express white nationalist views appealing. I do believe that the majority of Americans, the vast majority of Americans, find the president's comments against these four representatives in Congress to be abhorrent. I believe that the vast majority of Americans believe that diversity is one of the great strengths of our nation and believe in opportunity and having fair immigration policies, and the polling numbers show us that. So I can only guess at what the president's purpose is in trying to stir up this controversy, but he certainly did it. And I think that what he apparently doesn't care about is the great damage that he's doing to our country and to American children in particular who are listening to these words of hate. There's no other way to put it.
Are there that many people that out there that this resonates with that he's trying to appeal to?
You know, I think that ultimately we'll see the result as his policies, including his new asylum rules that he announced that are clearly unlawful, coming right on the heels one day after his comments about the members of Congress. I think that we're going to be successfully challenging those policies in court, just as we've successfully challenged virtually all of his immigration policies in court.
All right. Well, that's Cecilia Wang, Deputy Legal Director with the American Civil Liberties Union. Thanks for being with us. Well, as you just heard, President Trump is moving to end asylum protections for most Central American migrants. AP Washington correspondent Sagar Magani reports on that from the White House.
The administration is moving to end asylum protections for most Central American migrants. A new rule expected to go into effect tomorrow says any asylum seekers who first pass through another country will be ineligible for asylum in the U.S., though there will be exceptions, such as for migrants who've been trafficked. Current law says refugees can request asylum here regardless of how they arrive, also with exceptions. The administration's new policy will almost certainly face legal challenges, as have its earlier bids to send asylum seekers back over the border and keep some detained while their cases play out. Sagar Magani at the White House.
Well, the new proposal follows a multitude of hardline policies from the Trump administration. And joining us now is Justin Guest, Assistant Professor of Public Policy at George Mason University. Thanks so much for being with us, Justin. First of all, can we just get a reaction to the president's comments on those four congresswomen?
I think that this was a knee-jerk, instinctive reaction from the president that just sort of revealed the way he views many people of color. I think that it's a simplistic view that suggests that they are inherently from a different country, even when they are born and raised in the United States, in the case of three of the four of them, and possess U.S. citizenship and are very dedicated to the U.S. as the country of their future.
I would say this ties into the president's policies and hardline stance on immigration. It would appear that he's just not a fan of people from anywhere else, or people of color, or certain parts of the world. Would you agree that his immigration policies reflect that?
So given the president's history of even sometimes profane commentary about people, I think that he has an image in his mind about the kind of immigrant that is palatable. And that immigrant tends to be from a place like Norway, which is a country he has mentioned favorably in the past, and an immigrant who he believes to be high-skilled. Those are the immigrants that he believes to be tolerable and palatable and that the country should be pursuing. What that basically eliminates are people of color, people who may not possess the skills that he's looking for, and it's very possible those skills are even gendered. And it sends a message about what he wants the future kind of social demographics of the country to look like.
Well, a lot of people are saying that this is the beginning of his political campaign for re-election. Do you think that that's a winning strategy as far as the makeup of America right now? Would they get in line with that, or enough people agreeing with the president?
This is not the beginning of his campaign strategy. This was an instinctive knee-jerk reaction trying to divide the Democrats, and he stumbled upon a very hot fault line in light of the comments that he made, which were very offensive to many ethnic minorities born and raised and dedicated, devoted to the United States. Rather, this was a continuation of commentary and policies that he has made that suggests the way he approaches immigration more broadly. And I think, actually, it's really not in his favor. He has already established that he is skeptical about future immigration. He has already established that he is wary of many ethnic minorities, to put it lightly. And I think that what he would be better off doing is trying to triangulate that and to demonstrate to the American center that he's actually a reasonable person. Problem is that more and more comments like this, coupled and compounded by his earlier comments from Charlottesville and thereafter, only remind Americans that he's quite volatile and quite undisciplined. And so I actually think that this is going to sting, because people in the American center are not going to like to hear these kinds of these words and commentary.
Well, the president basically lost a very long battle over a question with the U.S. Census, which counts the number of people here. And he wanted a citizenship question on there. He lost with the Supreme Court, and he still fought it for a while there. How big of a loss was this?
So it's unclear whether this is actually a loss at all. The president wanted, and his administration wanted, a question on the U.S. Census that inquired about respondent citizenship status. The general pulse of opinion among experts, including myself, is that such a question would deter people of immigrant origin, who are nevertheless legitimately in the country or not, from participating in the census. And that would depress numbers, depress population statistics in places like California, Texas, large urban areas, which are dependent on the census for the allocation of resources and electoral power. And so the question is, this loss, because the question is no longer on there, does it actually make anyone feel better about participating in the census? And I'm not sure that's true. The question is whether the damage has been done, whether a lot of ethnic minorities and immigrant origin people are actually already still scared of participating in the census because they feel their fear that they'll be revealing information to the government that could be used against them.
All right. Justin Guest, he's Assistant Professor of Public Policy at George Mason University. Thanks so much for being with us. Here are some of the stories we're following at voanews.com. Iran threatens to revert to the pre-2015 nuclear development levels. A journalist who returned to her native Somalia to help locals has been killed in a hotel attack. Jailed Eritrean man mistaken for human trafficking kingpin faces deportation. And ballet and rhinos in the African bush. Find expanded coverage of these stories and more at voanews.com and on our VOA mobile app. This is International Edition. The European Union held talks Monday on whether a barter mechanism aimed at salvaging some trade with Iran might include oil as Europeans scramble to ease tensions between Iran and the United States. Joining us now from Paris is reporter Catherine Field. Catherine, I know the European Union held talks and they met. Tell us about it.
It was a meeting of the European Union's foreign ministers. They meet in Brussels from time to time, but this is the last meeting they're having before the summer break, and it's also a meeting that's come at a crucial time. It's exactly 4 years on from that landmark Iran deal, whereby this nuclear deal would see the lowering of the enrichment limits. And so it was a very important meeting, and at a time when tensions really are very concerning for European foreign ministers. They're seeing what happened last week when the United Kingdom seized an Iranian tanker off the coast of Gibraltar. Plus, there was that incident or near incident in the Straits of Hormuz. So European Union foreign ministers came together to really take stock of where it's at, and they came away issuing a statement through the European Union's foreign policy chief saying that this Iran nuclear deal is not in the best of health, but it's still alive. She said it does have to have its pieces held together in some way, because it's got to be held in peace, because it falls apart, it will be a terrible option for everybody. They also noted that, yes, Iran has said that it's going to step up the enrichment process again, but when they said that IAEA inspectors say they're only up to 4.5%, that's still well below the 20% purity that it was at when this deal was signed 4 years ago. So they're not concerned that there's been any real violation of the treaty so far, but that what they do want is that Iran and the U.S. reduce tensions and start a dialogue. What they say, get this going before the deal collapses, because then we're all in uncharted waters.
I can see that they're all in agreement that this deal needs to stay together, but how can it stay together without the United States when the U.S. is dealing such punishing sanctions against Iran and threatening the EU to not do business with Iran?
Well, that's exactly it. And this is what the Iranians are saying to the Europeans. They're saying, well, look, you have promised us that you will set up some sort of barter trade system so as we can be doing trade with you. And in a way, the Iranians have thrown the gauntlet down to the Europeans and say, okay, we'll put it in place. Now, the Europeans do say they are setting up this barter-based trade deal with Iran. It's still got to get going, but it does deal in products such as pharmaceuticals and food. Iran has said that it should really also include oil sales. But that is getting going. There are 10 countries involved with that, and the European Union foreign policy chief said that more are coming on board. But clearly, this isn't being done fast enough. So at the same time, though, it's a difficult position for the European Union, because the European Union knows that America is out on a limb on this one, that it is the only one that's walked away from the deal. The others, you've got Russia and China, are still standing by the deal. So, but the EU doesn't want Iran backed into a corner, and it doesn't really also want the US backed into a corner.
So what's next?
That's the problem. How can the European Union bring any sort of de-escalation to this? Well, to be honest, they even admit they're still in an impasse. There really is not much they can do, but they are convinced if they still have dialogue with the Iranians, they will be able to at least keep going in the hope that it will not push across into some sort of mechanism whereby you have to go into the dispute mechanism on this Iran nuclear deal. They say that really would be the end of it. And if they can keep Iran talking, and if they can keep moving to set up this barter-based trade line for Iran, so at least they're getting some sort of trade going through, then there is a hope.
All right, Paris-based reporter, That's Catherine Field. The head of the World Health Organization says he's reconvening the UN agency's expert committee to assess whether or not the continuing Ebola outbreak in Congo warrants being declared a global emergency. At a meeting convened in Geneva by the World Health Organization on Monday, Tedros Adhanom Ghebreyesus said the spread of Ebola to Goma, a city of 2 million people, was a potential game changer.
Both of these events encapsulate the challenges we continue to face on a daily basis in DRC. Just when we start to get control of the virus in one area, it appears in another. And violence and insecurity continue to undermine the response. We're dealing with one of the world's most dangerous viruses in one of the world's most dangerous areas.
He said the situation is one of the most complex humanitarian emergencies ever faced. The group has met 3 times previously and decided each time against declaring the epidemic to be an international emergency. You're listening to International Edition on VOA.
Hi, I'm Larry London, and I'm the host of Border Crossings, inviting you to join me for one of the best hours of request music possible on the radio. We've got all your favorite songs by your favorite singers. You tell us what to play. It's requests and dedications, and it happens every weekday right here on The Voice of America.
Could be French,
English,
Portuguese,
Bantu,
Arabic, etc.
It is the beat,
the African beat that counts.
The beat does all the translations.
It cuts across all languages and gives us the understanding that this is the African beat.
It is so distinct
and adhesive.
It binds us together.
African beat on The Voice of America, Mondays through Fridays, 0900 and 2000 Universal Time,
with David Bandy.
VOA's International Edition continues now. Well, on July 20th, 1969, American astronauts Neil Armstrong and Edwin Aldrin set foot on the lunar surface to be the first men on the moon. The U.S. space agency NASA is celebrating the 50th anniversary of this historic event in style by restoring and reopening the control room that handled the historic Apollo 11 mission. Today, it's a museum, but it looks every bit alive and real as real as it did in 1969. Leisha Bacaletz visited the control room, and Anna Rice narrates her story.
The Eagle has landed. These were the first words mission control engineers heard from the moon as a new chapter in space exploration opened.
We've just landed in the moon, and the crew shuts down the engine, and now while the world celebrates, my team has to keep working because we have to make sure it is safe to remain on the surface of the moon.
The Mission Control Center in Houston managed space flights for another 2 decades. In 1992, the control team moved to a more modernized part of the space center and a historic room was closed.
So they're cleaning up the stuff that was left on the consoles, getting rid of the water bottles, Coke cans. There was stuff occasionally in waste baskets that were around there, but basically, this place was not representative of historic mission control.
In 2013, a group of renovators won the contract to restore the room to the way it looked on July 20th, 1969.
35 interviews with the flight controllers, and they sat at each console and pointed out what buttons they interacted with the most and what they did at their console, and it really helped the restoration process to be able to figure out, you know, what was most important at that console.
The renovators spent 5 years doing meticulous research. The biggest challenge was restoring the consoles and making sure the big screens, the largest and most visual elements in the room, looked exactly as they did half a century ago.
Screen 1 and 2 and 5, for maybe over a year, we couldn't find out what was supposed to be on those screens during descent and landing. And after enough research, we finally caught a break and found the right video that showed just a piece of what we needed to do to reconstruct it.
No detail was too small. The renovators found stationery from the late 1960s, as well as ashtrays, cigarettes, and soda cans. The restored Mission Control Center is open for tourists who can see it through a large glass wall. For Felicia Bokalets in Houston, Texas, NRI's VOA News.
Pop star Ariana Grande, she's expanding beyond music and teaming up with one of the top fashion designers in the world. Givenchy on Monday unveiled their new campaign featuring Grande in a series of dramatic photos wearing chic clothing outfits, including a sparkling off-the-shoulder blouse and a stunning green pantsuit and more. The photos were posted on Instagram. That's not what I see. Look what I got. Look what you taught me. Yeah, for that I say thank you. You've been listening to International Edition. That does it for today's show, but you can find us anytime at voanews.com. Thank you for joining us. And thanks to our director, Tracy Carter, and our engineer, Jimmy Cook. I'm Lori London in Washington. Have a great day. I worry about nothing. Plus I met someone else. We having better discussions. I know they say I move on too fast, but this one gon' last. Cause her name is Ari, and I'm so good with that. So good with she that. Taught me love. She taught me patience. She handles pain. That's amazing. I've loved and I lost, but that's not what I feel. Look what I found. No need for searching. Yeah, all I say. Thank you. Thank you, thank you. Thank you, thank you. Thank you. I'm so, so grateful for my ass. Thank you. Thank you, thank you. So thank you, thank you. I'm so, so grateful for my ass. Thank you, thank you. Thank you, thank you. I'm so, so. One day I'll walk down the aisle, hold the hands of my mama. I'll be thanking my dad, cause she grew from the drama. Only one.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The United States is renewing its commitment to help strengthen its allies and partners in the region on their journey to self-reliance in the face of Russian efforts to undermine transatlantic unity and weaken democratic institutions through malign influence campaigns. In Europe and Eurasia, noted USAID Administrator Mark Green, the Kremlin's efforts are unmistakable. There is no other way to put it. Moscow is working relentlessly, undermining economic liberalization, reversing democratic development, and weakening the sovereignty of individual states. In response to this, USAID is stepping forward to better target its aid money and programs in support of democracies through a new Countering Malign Kremlin Influence Framework. The framework will help increase the economic and democratic resilience of partner countries in four ways. First, it aims to support democracy and rule of law by strengthening civil society organizations, promoting transparency, and supporting cybersecurity of electoral systems. Such programs have already seen success in countries such as Ukraine, where the U.S. invested approximately $2.7 million this year in elections, cybersecurity equipment, and training for the Central Election Commission. Grants for watchdog organizations help combat corruption in public institutions to make them more resilient to Kremlin interference. Second, the U.S. is fostering media independence throughout Eastern Europe to combat Kremlin-sponsored propaganda. With USAID funding, 11 investigative media outlets across Bosnia, Kosovo, Montenegro, North Macedonia, and Serbia are growing their audiences, diversifying revenue, and elevating their digital media presence. Lastly, USAID is promoting energy and economic independence. Our assistance, said Administrator Green, will include working with individual states to create effective, pro-growth, legal and regulatory frameworks and assisting them in joining well-functioning local and regional energy markets. This work has already begun, Administrator Green noted, with programs already underway in Ukraine and Moldova to transition both power systems and trade away from Russia and toward the West. We will join our friends in pushing back against authoritarian aggression and pushing forward and bolstering liberty's resilience, said Administrator Green. Most importantly, the administrator emphasized that USAID remains on the side of the people of the region, including Russian citizens. We know that the citizens of the region simply want liberty, free and fair elections, and a chance for better lives for themselves and for their children.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government. For a transcript of this and other VOA editorials, or to receive editorials by email, visit the VOA Editorials Internet homepage at www.voanews.com.
This is VOA News.